Before I begin today, does anyone have any questions? I should say you should feel free in the course of the lecture to raise your hand and ask a question. You know why I encourage that? Because the way the class like this is structured, with me just kind of droning on up here and you just sitting there taking notes and early in the morning when people are scarcely even awake, it helps to kind of get something more of a dialogue going, because it helps people, pay attention, makes the class a little bit more lively. So you should feel absolutely free to raise your hand if you don't understand something I'm saying, or if you want to take issue with it in some way. Okay? This is second of a two-part lecture on the Treaty of Versailles, the Peace of Paris, and so on. Just to remind you of what I was saying last time about why this stuff is so important. Because these issues of historical interpretation have a direct bearing on the fundamental theoretical questions political scientists are concerned with, international theorists are concerned with. The great issue that lies at the heart of this field of inquiry is the issue of realism. Realism versus liberalism. How is foreign policy to be conducted? How is war to be understood? And there, there's the normal view that you absorb from the general culture. War is to be understood in terms of aggression. You want to create a stable system. A stable system, is based on the rule of law, on respect for certain norms, principles of justice, and so on. Those are just common sense views that most people have before they begin to think seriously about these issues. And the power of the realist theory derives from the fact that it takes issue with those common assumptions. If we were just stating what everyone already knew, it wouldn't have any bite. Its power derives from its counterintuitive nature. You look at someone like Kennan, and basically the argument is, we think that standing up for moral principle is the way to have a stable system, but it works exactly the opposite way. You have these kind of this moralistic foreign policy. It leads to instability. It doesn't make for a more stable world. And implicitly, it's not an accident that the Peace of 1919, which I again remind you, is the only major peace settlement in the history of great power politics to be dictated by the three Western democracies and by them alone. That was not the case, obviously, in 1815. That was not obviously not the case in 1945. And yet the peace of 1919 was by far the most unstable peace in the history of great power politics. Much worse than the peace of 1945. Much worse than the peace of 1815. It's like an accident? That simple historical finding raises the question. It doesn't answer it, though. Right? How do you go about answering it? How do you go about getting a handle on these issues? My claim is there's only one way you can do it. One and only way you can do it. And that's by recognizing that there's a certain affinity between theoretical claims and specific historical interpretations. Those historical interpretations, in turn, are studyable in a way these general theoretical arguments aren't. They're studyable because you can examine them in the light of the hard empirical evidence, the historical evidence, the documents. Often documents that only became available 30 years after the fact, things that were secret at the time. We can analyze those historical interpretations and reach strong conclusions. Right? We can answer them definitively, more or less. And when we answer them, having recognized that they have, that those historical interpretations have a resonance, a direct bearing on these major theoretical issues. That way we can get insight into these theoretical issues. Right? You know, people recognize that the Versailles Peace failed, but the argument was, it's not Wilson's fault. You can't blame Wilson. You can't blame the kind of policy he pursued for what happened, because he didn't get his way. He was frustrated. Frustrated first by the European allies, Britain and France, who only kind of half accepted his way of looking at things, and then frustrated also by the American electorate that refused to endorse his policy, refused to ratify the Treaty of Versailles, basically refused to join the League of Nations, which was the heart of the Wilson conception. And it was for that reason that you had instability. The problem with the peace was not that it was a Wilsonian peace, the problem was that it was a non-Wilsonian peace, right? If true, that would have a major bearing on the theoretical issue we're concerned with. But is it true? Well, how do you go about seeing it? And here we kind of broke the issue down into two parts. The first part, which was dealt with in the lecture last time, was this whole notion that, on a general level, is the Versailles Peace in line with the what Wilson wanted? Did it mark the frustration of his views? And there, the kind of key argument was that, as soon as the United States entered the war, all thought of a peace of reconciliation thrown out the window. No longer any thought of peace without victory, compromise peace, peace without equals. All those notions that Wilson had laid out in his peace without victory speech, January of 1917, we go into the war 3 months later, and as soon as we go into the war, everything shifts overnight. You know? And now it's like, well, if we went into the war, that could only mean that that the other side is evil, because we are basically a good country, and the other side therefore must be the aggressor. And if you believe in moral principles, the rule of law, and so on, you gotta punish the aggressor. You gotta make sure the aggressor pays for his crimes. Not just the German leadership, but the entire German nation. They follow their leaders. This way of looking at things, and we saw this, I just read to you Wilson's own words, both in public and in private. It was important that there be a punitive peace. Germany had to be punished for her crimes. Because if she got away with all this stuff scot-free, how are you going to vindicate these principles? How are you going to establish the rule of law, a world based on what was just? And so you had to kind of punish the Germans, right? And we saw that, what the policy of the European countries was, British policy and French policy. French policy was the most interesting because they, Clemenceau, tended to think in realist terms, but that didn't translate precisely into a particular policy. There were three strings to his policy. The heart of the policy was you had to think in power terms. Germany is a stronger country than France. The only way of keeping the best way, at least, of keeping the Germans at bay was to maintain the wartime coalition. And this was the heart of the Clemenceau policy. To that end, I will make any sacrifice, he said, in that December 29, 1918 speech that I referred to before. We got to keep American and British troops deployed on the continent. We got to maintain this coalition because the three Western democracies taken together are more than a match for Germany. Right? Heart of Clemenceau policy. But what if the Americans and the British won't go along with it, as in fact proved to be the case, you know? Then you needed alternatives. You had to give some thought to that possibility. And what are the alternatives? The interesting thing here is that there are two alternatives. One is the possibility of taking very harsh measures against Germany, keeping Germany down for good, you know, limiting German power for good. Because if France had to deal with Germany by herself, and Germany was inherently a stronger country than France, then you needed some artificial constraints on German power. You needed limitations on the size of Germany's forces, land forces, air forces, navy, and so on. You needed to prevent the Germans from fortifying themselves. You needed to deploy your own forces on the right bank, the eastern bank of the Rhine River, so that if push came to shove, you were capable of using military force against Germany if the Germans tried to build up their strength, despite the provisions of the treaty. So a harsh policy is a possibility. A policy, in fact, that even looked toward separating the Rhineland off from the main part of Germany. Not necessarily annexing it by France, but creating an independent Rhineland that would no longer be part of Germany. You know, and under French influence. Right? And, you know, all these things would have an important effect in terms of rectifying the imbalance of power that would normally exist in the absence of these constraints. Right? But the interesting thing about Clemenceau's policy was that it didn't stop there. There was a third string to it, which was quite amazing when, you know, when people discovered that this was the case. You know, after it became clear in the course of the conference that America and Britain were not willing to go along with the sort of policy that Clemenceau preferred, the maintenance of the wartime coalition. What he did then was the French approached the Germans at the peace conference. You know, in this kind of proto-Gaullist rhetoric about, you know, the continental Europeans have to come together to kind of form a counterweight to the Anglo-Saxons, you know, a view that looked toward Franco-German reconciliation as the key to creating a freestanding Europe that could hold its own in world affairs against the British and the Americans, you know. And this was a policy, as we'll see, that you know, played a certain role in French thinking in the immediate post-war period. Okay, so things are very much in flux. Things are very much up in the air. That's at the general level. Right? The real test of what was going on is what was going on. The real test is what was happening at the more concrete level as the specific provisions of the peace treaty were being hammered out at the Paris Peace Conference. Okay? Because it may very well be that, you know, Wilson had all this, you know, punitive rhetoric, but when push came to shove, when you looked at what he was doing on specific issues, his basic moderation came out. He really did kind of resist the attempts of the French to kind of crush Germany. You know, he was still at heart thinking in terms of reconciliation as a fundamental goal. Possible. The only way to see whether that's an accurate portrayal of what was going on is to look at those negotiations. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to examine the negotiations in some detail, at a concrete level. And in doing so, we're going to be asking two questions. Issue by issue. Are these negotiations to be understood in terms of a conflict between relatively conciliatory Americans and the harsh French, with the British playing a kind of intermediate role, right? And then number two, we're going to look at the outcome of the negotiations, the sort of peace that eventually emerged, the provisions of the Treaty of Versailles on very specific issues, and we're going to ask whether those provisions are in line with the basic Wilson concept or at variance with it. All right, two tests. And we're going to begin with the territorial issues, and then we're going to look at the non-territorial issues. All very systematic. Territorial issues, we're going to begin with the western frontiers of Germany, and then we're going to look at the other frontiers of Germany. I'm going to apply those two tests, and we're going to look at the non-territorial issues, like I said. All right? So let's begin. the territorial issues, Germany's western borders. What do you find? Well, with regard to Germany's western borders, this is the question that actually with the kind of traditional view, explains things the best, right? Because it's quite true that the French were thinking in terms of a permanent occupation of the Rhineland, especially the left bank of the Rhine, the area between the Rhine River and northern France. Okay? This blue line here, that's the Rhine River, and we're talking about this whole area over there. And this was opposed most strongly by the British, by Lloyd George, British Prime Minister. His view was that if the French did something like that, an independent Rhineland or anything like that, permanently occupied Rhineland under French influence, that would poison the peace of Europe the same way Germany's annexation of Alsace-Lorraine had poisoned the peace of Europe in the period from 1871 to 1914. No, opposed it. And a deal was worked out. The deal was that there would be a temporary occupation of the Rhineland, that as long as Germany complied with the terms of the treaty, the occupying forces would be withdrawn in stages. The northern third of the Rhineland would be the occupation forces would be withdrawn after 5 years, the middle zone after 10 years, and the entire Rhineland after 15 years, right? As long as Germany complied with the terms of the treaty. Okay? However, the Rhineland as a whole was to be demilitarized. In other words, the Germans weren't supposed to station troops there. They weren't supposed to fortify it. Right? Because if they did, then what was to prevent them from building up their power? And then once they were strong, they could move against these countries to the east and so on, and just overthrow the whole Versailles system. All right. Is this and then the French were also given a treaty of guarantee by Britain and America. The British, however. Commitment to this arrangement was dependent on America also ratifying the treaty, which didn't happen. And so the British commitment also expired. But the whole idea of a treaty of guarantee was that in the event of renewed German aggression, Britain and America would come to the side of France. Okay? And although the Americans reneged on their promise, and thus the British were allowed also to renege, the French didn't go back on the whole deal with respect to the Rhineland, because the Rhineland was still to be occupied only on a temporary basis according to those rules that I had discussed before. Okay. This provision, temporary occupation of the Rhineland, that's in line with the basic Wilson philosophy, isn't it? A generation of thoughtfulness. Germany had committed a crime. You couldn't keep Germany down forever, but the Germans should do what it took to make penance for the crimes they had committed. And that meant Germany would not be allowed to have the same political rights as the victor powers for a generation, for 15 years, the same period that the Rhineland was supposed to be occupied. Okay? In line with the basic Wilson approach, right? Wilson didn't really object in a fundamental way to those provisions in the treaty. And in fact, even during the conference, his objection was less vociferous than that of Lloyd George. Okay? What about Germany's other borders? Yeah?
Wait, so you just said that Germany didn't like take that much offense to this provision?
Oh, they certainly did. I didn't say anything about the German reaction.
What did you say about like offense? Like the last line right before you started moving on.
Which line? Frankly, which line was that? I don't remember.
Germany would not have the same political rights.
Yeah, Germany would not have the same political rights, according to the Allies. I mean, the Germans certainly would take offense at this, as we'll see. This is a deep source of resentment to the Germans. It was all based on the assumption the Germans had caused the war. Because why else would there be any justification for not giving them the same political rights as anyone else? Right? The answer to that was, well, the Germans had caused the war. Wilson took this for granted. They all took this for granted. The Germans had caused the war. You couldn't act as though they didn't have responsibility for the war. They were going to have to pay a price for what they had done. The price was a generation of thoughtfulness, Wilson's phrase. You know, they could not be treated the same way as everyone else. Their political rights would be limited. Their political rights, meaning their right to rearm. Incidentally, you all realize that even today, Germany, the unified Germany of the post-Cold War period, does not have the same political rights as other countries. The treaty that provided for the reunification of Germany, the Treaty of Moscow of 1991, this prevented Germany from arming herself with nuclear weapons. And there's no way a non-nuclear power could stand up to the nuclear powers around her politically. This was, in effect, this was a more extreme limitation on German power than anything that was imposed at Versailles. But I don't want to get ahead of myself too much. The territory provisions in the east, or in other areas of Germany. What do you have here? A Polish state is created. This Polish state includes this area here, surrounded by this pink line, even though it's marked in blue in the map. It's all the blue area is that's pre-1914 Germany. Now, this whole area between Poland proper and the Baltic Sea, which runs along the sides of the Vistula River, this is called the Polish Corridor. It's given to Poland by the Treaty of Versailles. It separates a big chunk of Germany called East Prussia, this whole area here, from the main part of Germany. Area that had been German before the war is now given to Poland. Is this to be understood as Wilson being outmaneuvered by the French and so on? The interesting thing here is that that provision and the other provision relating to Poland, which is that Poland was given another chunk of pre-war Germany called Upper Silesia. That's over here. And initially, Poland was to get all of Upper Silesia. Upper Silesia is important economically because it's the second most important coal-producing area in Germany after the Ruhr. I mean, the quality of the coal they have there is brown coal called lignite. It's not nearly as good as the black coal you found in the Ruhr. But it was important enough so that a metallurgical industry had grown up as a standard around the coal mines. And to make Poland economically viable, Upper Silesia was given to Poland initially. And then what happened is that the British objected to the Upper Silesian thing, and they agreed that there would be a plebiscite held in 1921 that would determine the fate of Upper Silesia. And on the basis of the plebiscite, the League of Nations would decide what to do with Poland, with Upper Silesia. Whether it go to Poland or Germany or what. Is this a product of a conflict between the Americans and the French? No, because the Americans and the French were on the same side on these Polish issues. You know, the Americans believed in the resurrection of the Polish state. You know, it's the principle of self-determination. You know, the Poles deserved a state of their own. They deserved independence. And then once you were talking about resurrecting the Polish state, that state had to be made viable economically. The Poles needed access to the sea. The Vistula River is the lifeline of Poland. And so the area around the Vistula River should be given to Poland. The Upper Silesia, given to Poland. All right. Was this a violation of Wilson's principles? Here the issue is quite interesting. Because the population of the Polish corridor, as it was called, there were these people called Kachubians, who spoke a dialect of Polish at home, but having been ruled by Germany for so many years, they actually, a lot of them, had come to think of themselves as Germans. The Poles' argument was that these are ethnic Poles. They had been kind of brainwashed into thinking of themselves as Germans. We should have a chance to unbrainwash them or rebrainwash them into thinking of themselves as Poles. And so what is the basis of nationality in the Wilson theory? Is it ethnicity, the kind of language you speak, the genes that you have? Or is it what you consider yourself as being? Right? One of the reasons why this was a problem was that exactly the opposite set of principles applied with Alsace-Lorraine, or at least in Alsace. The Alsatians spoke a dialect, you know, at home, not in the schools and things like that, but at home they spoke a dialect of German, you know. But they had come to think of themselves as French, having been part of France since the age of Louis XIV in the 17th century. Well, you want them back in the as French, despite the fact that they ethnically Germans. You want them back in France because they think of themselves as French. Well, shouldn't the same principle apply in the case of the population of the Polish corridor? Similarly, in the case of Upper Silesia, a lot of the miners there were Poles. You know, mining is not a pleasant occupation, right? And so before the war, a lot of Poles had gone to the area, work in the mines. And a large part of the Upper Silesian population were Poles. But once again, the question is, they had come, a lot of them, to think of themselves as Germans. I mean, even today, you go over to Germany, you see a lot of Polish names on part of people who are as German as anyone else, it seems. Again, Wilson sided with the French on Poland. The French liked the idea of an independent Poland because they thought it would be a certain counterweight to German power in the East. Right? France and Germany together, well, maybe they could... France and Poland together could serve to kind of limit Germany's ambitions. And Wilson believed in self-determination, and he went along with this stuff. And it was the British who took the other line, mainly because they were contemptuous of the Poles on what they viewed as racial grounds. We would say national grounds. Poles are immature. They're not capable of running their own country. They'll mistreat the Germans. This is going to create all kinds of problems. That was the British view. There was one little problem having to do with this, and that was that the port city at the mouth of the Vistula River... It was called Danzig in those days. Now it's Gdansk. This was a German city. 99% of the population of Danzig were Germans. And so it was, in that case, it was just a little bit too embarrassing to give Danzig to Poland pure and simple. And so they created a free city of Danzig under the authority of the League of Nations. Right, neither part of Germany nor part of Poland. It's going to create problems, as you all know, in 1939. Okay. Is this at variance with Wilson's principles as laid out in the 14 points? Well, one of the 14 points called for the resurrection of Poland, a viable Poland with access to the sea, in line with Wilson's principles. Wilson's advisors on this issue, you know, were pro-Polish. and no trouble siding with the French. All right, so right away you see there's a problem there. Going further south, the whole issue of the German-speaking areas in what had been the Habsburg monarchy, the new rump state of German Austria. They said this state, although it was ethnically German and the inhabitants wanted to merge themselves into Germany proper, largely for economic reasons. Because, you know, the problem with the dividing up of the Habsburg monarchy after 1919 is that you have this huge metropolis, Vienna, which had come into being as the chief city of a whole vast empire. Now that empire had been broken up into its constituent parts, it was hard for Vienna to remain economically viable. And so the Austrians wanted to become part of the new German Republic. The Allies said no. And they said that none of them had any problems with saying, no, it's not a violation of the principle of national independence, national sovereignty, to ask that the Austrians remain independent, in their view. They opposed it because to allow Austria to merge itself into Germany would accentuate the imbalance of power between France and Germany. It would make the German population twice as great as that of France. You know, and that was considered not desirable for geopolitical reasons by all three of the Allies. No big problem there. Various other areas like Germany's north, her border with Denmark, contained an area of mixed population, mixed German and Danish population, called this Schleswig-Holstein, especially the northern area. Schleswig had mixed populations. This was settled by a plebiscite. The plebiscite drew the border in accordance with national preferences. No problem there. Okay? So those are territorial issues, right? Not quite in line with the standard interpretation, right? What about the non-territorial issues? War criminals, the War Guilt Clause, as it was called, Article 231 of the treaty, that Germany agreed to accept responsibility for the war. The war criminals would be brought to trial and so on. Here, it's the British who take the lead on all of this stuff. And they convince the Americans to go along with it with this whole argument about the rule of law. How could you believe in the rule of law if you don't punish lawbreakers? Wilson had little trouble accepting that argument. The French were not particularly interested in this stuff, but since their allies felt strongly about it, they went along with it. Huh? The disarmament provisions. Germany was to be disarmed. Germany's army was limited to 100,000 men based on long-term conscription. The French would have given Germany 200,000 men based on conscription. Long-term conscription they viewed as undesirable because it would make the military into a state within the state, a special military caste, rather than drawn from the nation as a whole. In France, conscription is associated with democratic ideals, the nation in arms. The British, however, didn't like conscription, and they thought it would militarize society and preferred long-term enlistees. The British got their way on this. Okay. There's one aspect of the disarmament provisions that's worth noting, however, that this part of the treaty was introduced by a phrase to the effect that Germany was being disarmed. You know, very small navy, no air force, limited army, border fortresses to be raised, and so on. Germany was being disarmed in order to make possible a more general disarmament of nations. And the Germans viewed this as implicitly an ally promise that if Germany disarmed, they too would eventually disarm. Why was that put in? because liberal thought believes in the importance of general disarmament. Right? It ignored the reality that if everyone disarmed down to Germany's level, there would be nothing to prevent the Germans from rearming up to whatever level they wanted, because the Allies would be too weak to do anything about it. Okay. League of Nations. This is the heart of Wilson's. Yeah?
I'm sorry, can you just repeat one more time that they were disarmed in order to make possible a more general disarmament?
That was a provision in the treaty. That wasn't the real thinking.
Oh, okay.
But they have to stick this stuff in about, you know, how important general disarmament is. Because this is like a fig leaf. They don't want to come across as saying, well, we're doing this because this is in our interest, and we won the war, and the Germans lost, so we're going to do what we want. That's they can't behave that way. You know, it's like, you know that phrase about hypocrisy being the tribute that vice pays to virtue? Well, a big tribute was being paid, right? They included this provision in order to kind of square the circle between their own ideals and what they were actually doing. But it created a certain moral vulnerability in the treaty system. Okay, League of Nations. The key thing there is Article 10 of the League of Nations, the kind of general guarantee of the territorial integrity of all the member states. British didn't like it. For that matter, a lot of senators in the United States didn't like Article 10 of the League either. And there was a certain effort on the part of the British to water it down, to weaken the guarantee. But for Wilson, Article 10 was the heart of the covenant. You know, you needed to have teeth in the covenant, clear promises in the covenant about what would happen if the territorial integrity of any member state was threatened. Right? Without it, he said, the League would be nothing more than an influential debating society, if you took the British view. On the other hand, the French wanted to make these things very explicit. They wanted the League to have, in effect, an army composed of national contingents to enforce these provisions. And Wilson was dead set against that. He said that to do that, to create an army that the League would control to as an instrument of enforcing all this stuff, this would be to substitute international militarism for national militarism. He didn't want any of it. All right. Again, this whole simple view of conciliatory Americans versus vengeful Europeans. It's not borne out by this particular story, and the League, as it was elaborated in the treaty, very much in line with Wilson's conceptions. Like all these other things, very, you know, perfectly willing to go along with it. Okay, and finally we come to the reparations. Right. I have to say, I have a especially warm feeling when I come to talk about this stuff, because this is my PhD dissertation. And even though it was many years ago that I did this work, I still remember just how shocked I was when I saw, you know, how we had been sold a bill of goods, how the reality was so much at variance with what people had said. The standard argument is that the Treaty of Versailles is so harsh, Germany's being crushed, or that one of the ways they wanted to crush Germany was by forcing Germany to pay these impossible reparations. Everyone knew that they were far beyond Germany's capacity to pay. It was just an excuse to give the French a chance to intervene with military force against Germany, to keep smashing Germany, and that was the real reason why the Treaty of Versailles proved to be so unstable, because you couldn't, you know, have a stable system based on that kind of thing. It turns out that couldn't be further from the truth. The truth is totally different in this whole area. So let me think about where to begin. What sort of arrangement did the French want to have at the end of the war? They were not counting on the reparations or on a large reparation bill to help France reconstruct the devastated areas, because don't forget, the war is fought mainly in northern France, not in Germany. Germans threw up their arms and surrendered basically before the war was over. before the war had touched their territory, is what I mean. What the French were counting on for Reconstruction was that the British, and especially the Americans, would continue supplying them with the goods that they needed to reconstruct their areas. They had this notion that, well, it was a joint struggle. All three of the Western democracies had an interest in defeating Germany. And the burdens of the joint struggle should be shared equitably. The French shouldn't have to bear the lion's share of those costs. You know, this is what the French call the principle of equality and community of sacrifice. But Wilson was having none of it. In this regard, U.S. policy in World War I, or in the post-World War I period, is radically different from what it was after World War II. There was no Marshall Plan after World War I. Quite the contrary. Wilson was infuriated by this French notion that the United States should continue, you know, providing them with goods and so on, simply because we had been allies during the war. His whole notion was, they're lucky to get what they got. It's thanks to us that they won the war, and what nerve they have asking for yet more stuff. And as soon as the war was over, you know, they dismantled all the wartime controls, they ended the wartime assistance, you know, we took the harness off. November 1918. You know, the flow of American resources to France, it just ended practically overnight. Very, very hard for the French to accept, because their great hope was that they wouldn't have to rely on reparations from Germany for reconstruction and so on. The Americans would help them out, help them reconstruct. When it turned out not to be the case, the French said, well, what sort of leverage do we have? Well, we have this big piece of leverage. We could tell the Americans, look, if you're not going to give us what we need, we're going to try and get it from somewhere. German industry is intact. We're going to be forced to demand all the stuff from Germany. We're going to be forced to demand these huge reparations. It was an instrument, these high reparation demands were an instrument of pressure. And when the Americans were intransigent and wouldn't bend to French pressure, then the French kind of basically said, well, they accommodated to that reality and they stated their real demands. And their real demands were fairly moderate, and they had no problem, French experts, reaching agreement with their American counterparts about how much Germany was to pay. Germany was to pay $30 billion spread out over many years, right? 5% interest, 1% for amortization. That meant that the effective burden on the German economy was something like 5 or 6% of national income, gross domestic product, we would say nowadays. Nothing beyond what Germany could pay, especially since Germany was no longer had to maintain a large military establishment. Okay. Why then couldn't you have a moderate settlement of that sort in the treaty? Because the British opposed it. The British came up with huge demands that the French thought were ridiculous, and said so in these meetings at which the terms of the reparation settlement were hammered out. What was the American attitude? Did they side with the French against the British in an attempt to kind of limit how much Germany could pay to a figure that the Americans thought was, you know, serious but still reasonable? No, that's the American experts wanted to do that. Wilson, however, took the opposite line. Because the British, in order to rationalize their large reparation demands, they couldn't just limit themselves to getting compensation for the damage done to their property and so on during the war. Because if that was the principle, the bulk of what Germany would pay would go to France, because Britain had not been touched in any major way during the war. So the British said, it's not just damage to property that we're entitled to compensation for. You know, we're entitled to compensation for a much broader range of damages, and especially we're entitled to have the Germans compensate us for the pensions and separation allowances that we have to pay as a result of the losses we suffered in the war. Okay, and this effectively would have doubled the size of the bill. And Wilson's advisors told him, look, you can't do this. Because the same logic that ruled out war costs, the Germans should have to pay for war costs, which was the initial British demand, which would have led to truly astronomical figures. He said the same logic that ruled that out should also rule out pensions. Wilson said, Wilson believed that the British had a right to pensions because human life was not less valuable than a factory or a mine or something like that that had been destroyed. You know, and so he sided with the British. He overruled his advisors. One of his advisors later recalled his exact comments. He said, you know, when they said the same logic that ruled out war costs should also rule out pensions, he says, logic, logic, I don't give a damn about logic. I'm going to include pensions. You know, it's like the French, you know, they were very frustrated. They, when this issue was discussed, they actually said that they were willing to go back to an interpretation of the 14 points, pure and simple, restoration of the devastated territories, which would have meant that the Germans would have paid only like $20 billion, you know, something like 4% of GDP. You know, not a huge sum by any means. But the Americans wouldn't hear of it, right? Well, this and it's at this time that the French make these overtures to the Germans at the peace conference, saying we should come together against the Anglo-Saxons. Let's work this thing out on a business-like basis, and so on. Nothing came of these overtures, but the fact that they were made by Clemenceau's main advisor. Is very serious, very important, and we'll see the follow-through on this stuff later on, okay? So what does this tell us about the, you know, those two tests that we're applying? A conflict between conciliatory Americans and vengeful French? Quite the contrary, right? It's Wilson's moralism was responsible for his agreement to include the pensions in the bill. You know, human life is worth as much as property. Right? Doesn't matter that this is a violation of the pre-armistice agreement, or at least as it would normally be interpreted. You know, doesn't matter that he was kind of going back on what the Germans were led to think in the 14 points. Right? Doesn't matter that the French would have preferred a much more moderate reparation settlement, would have preferred an arrangement based on America continuing to be involved in Europe and help Europe rebuild, not because America felt any moral obligation to do so, but simply because removing the poison introduced in the system by the need to saddle Germany with any reparation, major reparation settlement, would have been desirable if your goal is to create a stable international order in Europe. Wilson, unlike his successors after World War II, was simply incapable of thinking in those terms. All right, so where does this leave us? Sadie, you look at this stuff. Germany's bound to resent a lot of these things. The war guilt, the reparations, you know, all the fact that Germany is not given equal rights and so on. Germany's going to resent it. Germany's going to be tempted to resist it. What are you going to do if Germany resists? And here's the other half of the Wilsonian philosophy that comes into play. You can't use force against Germany if Germany resists, because force is only warranted in wartime, you know? And it has no real role in peacetime international relations. It's wrong to enforce all this stuff. Right? What could have been worse? What could have been worse? A settlement that provokes deep German resentment and is bound to lead to German resistance, but a conviction on your part that you can't do anything about it if Germany resists. You can't use force against Germany. What could have been more unstable? Right? And think in terms of, if you buy this argument, if you accept that conclusion, what this tells us about the basic Wilsonian philosophy. You know, Kennan was basically right. It really did pave the path to huge instability. And we'll see as we look at the international politics in the post-Versailles period just what the problems were and the degree to which they were rooted in the specific kind of peace that was worked out in 1919 in Paris. A peace, all right, we'll have to insist on this point, that is very much in line with Wilson's principles. It didn't mark the defeat of Wilson. It was the sort of peace that was in conformity with what he said he wanted at the time. Okay, so let me just end there, and next time I'm going to be talking about 1919 to 1923. Don't forget, no class on Monday. It's a holiday, so all this stuff will be on Wednesday.
The audio for today's lecture. My grandmother or my aunt passed away yesterday.
Send me an email. Okay. Tell me that, and that's a legitimate excuse.
Thank you, Professor.
It just reminded me I should. His request is going to be on the tape. All right, there we go.